Hello, this is Jesse Perryman, and along with my co-host Justin Tang, we thank you to another edition of the Flag Hunters Golf Podcast. This week on the pod, we've got the head coach of the Dutch Junior Association. His name is Andreas Kali. Well, I'll tell you what, all you got to do is go over to Andreas's Instagram, and you can see clips that he puts up of his students. And you look at these golf swings and you go, wow, all right, this guy is producing a potential juggernaut to come out of such a small country, especially in comparison to the United States. But it's a fun hour, great hour. Andreas talks about his story and coaching kids to not only become great golfers, but to become the best versions of themselves. And it's super cool. Andreas is heavily influenced by Andy and Mike, Andy Plummer and Mike Bennett of the Stack and Tilt. But what's interesting about this is that he doesn't teach everybody the same. So you don't see a uniform of the same pattern per kid when you go on to either his website or his Instagram. And I think that's really interesting. And one thing to note before we get into the main pod, I wanted to bring up here. It's interesting to me that Europe is kicking our ass in the Ryder Cup. But when we look behind the veil of it, it doesn't surprise me because these countries, particularly in the Netherlands and in Sweden and the smaller countries up there, they take care of their kids. The kids might pay a small fee at the beginning of the year, and then the club that they belong to, their members at, and they take care of them. They pay for their instruction, they pay for their travel and their golf tournaments. And it really is pretty cool because they all grow up competing against each other. And it's like iron sharpens iron. I think there's a community that's being developed, as well as the kids being pushed via competition to become the best versions of themselves on the golf course. And I think that in the United States, we're lacking that. And I just wanted to throw that in there. I think that we need to really get back to, if we're going to create and develop talent in the United States, that this model that they have over in Europe might be extremely beneficial to us. And I don't think it would cost a whole heck of a lot of money, a couple of fundraisers, and your kids are scored away for the year. And it doesn't surprise me that in Europe and internationally, they're developing some great players and some superstars. And not that we don't hear in the U.S., but it's much more lonely, the road. Whereas in Europe, you do have a community. I just wanted to throw that in there. I'm going to put everything in the show notes on how to get a hold of Andreas, myself, and Justin. And then once again, I want to give a special thanks to TaylorMade and Adidas for their support. And I hope everyone is having a great week. I hope everybody listens to Andreas. He's pretty economical with his words, and he means what he says and says what he means. So hopefully everybody will have a good week, and cheers to all. This is Jesse Perryman welcoming you to another edition of the Flag Hunters Golf Podcast, along with my co-host, Justin Tang, who is at the Tanamera Golf Club in Singapore, where it is always summer. And I'm sure our guest in this episode and I would like to be alongside Justin, because I'm in cold, rainy California, and Andreas is in Copenhagen, Denmark, or just north of Copenhagen. Andreas Kali, welcome, my friend. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks, guys.
Justin, thanks.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks, Jesse. Thanks, Andreas, my friend. Andreas needs no introduction to our listeners. He's the head coach of the Danish Junior Golf Academy, was named a part of Golf Digest's Best International Teachers. He has helped more than 130 players get in the Danish national team since its beginning in 2007. The DJGA has produced numerous Solheim Cup winners and Olympic participants, European Tour winners, Eisenhower Trophy winners, European champions, multiple NCAA All-Americans, and national champions. Tell us, Andreas, how did you get here? That was quite a mouthful.
How did I get here? Yeah. That was a lot. I want to correct you. We haven't had any DP World Tour winners yet. How did I get here? Well, I used to play golf. I thought I was going to play the Ryder Cup myself. Watched Thomas Bjorn play Valderrama in 97, first thing ever playing it. And I was like, you know what? I want to do that. That's what I want to do. So from then, I was probably 14 years old, basically dropped everything I had and just wanted to see how good I could get at golf. For a long time, I went the right direction. So I got into the boys' national team, got into the men's national team, got a scholarship to play college golf in the States. Kept improving and actually thought I was on track for something because I was getting better every year. And then all of a sudden, like, it started going, I was about to say sideways, but it went downhill pretty quickly. Got a lot worse. Ended up, I don't know, shooting, like having the scoring average just below 70 my freshman year of college to from the middle of my sophomore year. Basically, after I signed a scholarship at a D1 school, I think I averaged just below 80. So about 10 strokes higher. Got pretty bad and all of a sudden, like, started meeting adversity for the first time. You know, met with whatever the smartest people that I thought they were, did what I was told, ended up getting worse. Met another guy who helped me out quite a fair bit. So got the game back on track, ended up turning professional just because I felt like I needed to at least try it out. Did all right, played for 4 years, didn't owe anybody any money. So I guess that's already a success right there. And then after my fourth year, I found out I wasn't progressing how I wanted to. And honestly, didn't really like it that much anymore. And then by accident, a good friend of mine who was a head pro needed an apprentice, asked me if I wanted to be that. And I was like, you know what, I don't know what else to do. That is, I guess, 14 years ago now. And then started to actually, for the first time, really getting interested in how golf works. Before that, I just wanted to compete. I was never a very good ball striker, so got really interested in like how the swing would work. Got into, you remember this, Justin, got it, like, stumbled upon the Gotham Golf Block, like, back in the day when it was still running. And there was this big golfing machine page that I really liked because there was some sort of answers there. It wasn't non-answers. There was at least like some sort of explanation of what was going on and what was important and what was maybe not important. So did the golfing machine studied that for a long time. If you study the golfing machine long enough, you stumble upon something with Mac O'Grady or some tapes because you want to learn more. Did that then... Actually, I think it was in 2012, maybe. Mike Bennett and Andy Plummer came to the Danish PGA Summit to present, and then they did an extra day of network training for Stack and Tilt. Attended that, saw some of the best golf lessons I'd ever seen in my entire life. So got infatuated with that, how fast they could improve players, how fast they can get players to hit the ball better, and just thought it was incredible. So went down that journey. Got hired in... Was that now 12 years ago to run the Danish Junior Golf Academy, and been doing that ever since. Got fortunate to stumble upon some young guys when they were between the age of 11 and 14 years old. Did my very best with them, tried to help them out with everything I could. They would ask me a bunch of questions that I didn't know the answer to, so I had to find out. Found out that there was a lot of people out in the world who were really, really helpful. And you know, I didn't know how good these players were, but turns out that they were good enough to be, well, at least two of them is on DP World Tour now. One of them, who I helped out for a long time, is the only Danish one on the LPGA Tour. Some of them are still, like, they're ended up at big schools in the States, so like Oklahoma State, Texas, Florida, Colorado, Arkansas, TCU, and many more places. I didn't know they were going to get that good because I didn't really know. I knew they were good. I just didn't know how good they were compared to everybody else. It turns out that they've been doing all right.
Do you teach the Hogard boys or did you teach the Hogard twins?
No, they're from the West Coast. They, I've been looking at those boys since they were like 12 years old when I go out to tournaments. And it was rare that any of my guys would beat them. Happened every now and then, but they were freaking amazing ever since they were young.
So you mentioned the early 2000s, mid-2000s. Those were golden days, man. of golf instruction, I feel. You know, Ralph Perez, I still keep in touch with him, Gotham Golf Blog. I think he was a pivotal part of the movement. Javier Niga, same thing.
Yeah, I know Javier.
Yeah, those are really great times. No, you know, when you said your stroke average went from sub 70 to 80, what happened there?
Well, I got into the men's national team because I did really, really well in college. And the coach who was the guy working with me was like, all right, if you want to take the next step, we got to make a couple of adjustments. And I hit a pretty big draw. So you know what? He was probably right that, you know what, that thing probably had to get like at least tightened up. But I think we're at a time where the ball flight laws were backwards and all these different things. I felt like I was a good student, so I'd pay attention that the ball would start on the path and curve away from the and curve to where the face was pointing. And we practiced some things where I guess we would open up my club face a little bit to the path, or at least open up more to the path than it was, and we'd move the path a little bit more to the left. And you know what? For a while, I actually was straightening that thing out. The problem was when that ball started right and cutting, my answer to that solution was that the ball was starting right, so I had to swing the club more to the left, right? And I actually never figured that out until I stopped playing, until we did the TrackMan stuff. But I could still play some golf, so I mean, as long as I didn't hit the ball that started right and cut, I'd probably shoot in the 60s. But if that shot happened on number two of a tournament round, for sure wouldn't break 80, because my solution for that shot was swinging more to the left, which was just adding more right curve. And I think at the end of it, I'll never forget this. I played Virginia Country Club for the Long Beach tournament, and I am paired with Davy Vanderwalt and Gary Woodland, who hit it freaking far. Like I was never long. Like I was kind of on the short end of average, I guess. But when you've got what I would, if I look back on it, I'd probably have a face to path that was like 12 degrees open. Like I'll never forget it, standing on the ninth, I think it was ninth, like a par five. I'm standing in the ninth fairway and I'm over 100 yards behind these two guys off the tee going like, I'm not sure like how the hell I'm supposed to compete with this.
I'm not sure how good your short game was back then, but I don't think any short game would be good enough to overcome a 100-yard difference.
And mine was freaking good. Like that was my I could chip and putt, and I got for sure that those 2 years where I just kept getting worse, my chipping and putting kept getting better. Like it was I had to. But I still like hell. I'll still like to this day if I go play a course and I've got wind off the left and OB down the right. Like I still get the twitches just because I've been standing on some of those tee boxes for forever, just hitting one ball after the next.
Yeah, and I think over a period of time, the brain just can't handle that kind of pressure where you're literally giving up 100 yards to everyone.
Yeah, well, I got it back, right? So I got a new coach and he explained like how this would work out. And like he didn't explain it like through the ball flight loss, but at least I got some sort of control. But if somebody just had told me like that ball that starts right and cuts, it's because the face is open to the path. It's not because your path is too far to the right. That would have, I mean, I know now, like I play almost just as good now, and I don't play golf anymore as I did when I played professional, just because I know more and I understand more.
So here's the irony. It took another Dane, Fredrik Tuxen, to shed light on the actual ball flight laws. That's the irony.
And you know what? I was they're 15 minutes from me. I was way back in the day when I was an amateur golfer before I went to the States, we had actually hit on like the very, very first TrackMan, which was this like silver, like huge looking case. It wasn't orange or anything. It was silver and green where it only measured the golf ball. Like they were testing it and they wanted some guys to test it. And they came out to our club to do it. So yes, Fredrik is, it's what he's done for golf instruction for golfers is it moved the golf instruction quite a fair bit in the right direction.
Yeah. I should put him in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, something you mentioned which was very interesting to me was this. You said your short game kept getting better as your long game deteriorated. And that's the genius of the human mind, how adaptive it can be. And how it seeks solutions to problems.
Yeah.
And going back to your deterioration, making swing changes are very similar to making changes in a computer code. It takes time. Unfortunately, when you finally realize that there's a problem, it becomes a challenge to untangle the problem unless you have a system. So what's your coaching process? And then I like to segue into systematic coaching and what coaches misunderstand about having a system. And last one is, what's the difference between a system and a method?
Yeah. Where do you want to start?
What's your coaching process?
My coaching process is biased. There's no doubt it is. And it is biased towards my own experiences as well. It's also biased towards the people I've learned from, right? My process is, first of all, it's just defining, like, what defines a good golf swing, right? And what is a good golf swing supposed to do? And I would say a good golf swing is, well, first of all, it can't cause like harm to the person swinging the club. But then on top of that, what does it have to do? Well, by definition, it has to produce like consistent face contact in the consistent place on the face. Doesn't have to be the center. I think we've seen plenty of good players who hit it slightly towards the heel just to like remove a little bit of drop, or the other way around, hit it slightly towards the toe to remove a little bit of fade. But in a consistent spot, it has to produce a consistent horizontal and vertical low point so it can hit the ground in a consistent spot with the whatever amount of depth that I want to do, or I can not hit the ground behind the golf ball with the proper amount of depth. I think that's what a good golf swing does. Then on top of that, it produces some sort of functional club speed and ball speed and launch and spin, depending on like, you can, again, you can take this little puzzle piece and add it up depending on if the player swings it. If it's a girl who swings the driver 90 miles per hour versus one of my guys who swings the driver 137 miles per hour, it's different. Like, what's functional launch, spin, like what they need. Then on top of that, then it creates a consistent starting direction and a fairly consistent curvature. And if somebody does that, they by definition have a good golf swing, in my opinion. So you would say, if you look at it that way, Scottie Scheffler has the best golf swing in the world right now.
Oh, but his legs are all over the place.
Yeah, I agree. And I agree. But if I look at it backwards and I went movement first and not how a club hits a ball second, then I would not say he has the best golf swing. Then I would likely say that Adam Scott has the best golf swing,
which is really a golf swing I like,
sure. Right? But it's not. It's. I mean, I would. Who the hell would take Scottie Scheffler? Unless it's an ego thing or it's like a vanity thing, everybody in their right mind would take Scottie Scheffler's golf game over Adam Scott's. At least their long game.
You need to unpack that for our listeners. A lot of guys go about it the other way. Like, oh, it's going to be beautiful. Movement-based assessment. Whereas what you're saying is, it's going to be functional. Let's look at the function first, then we move backwards. But I think a lot of guys look at it the other way around.
They might. Not the people that I hang out with. So I don't really know what everybody else does, at least unless it's people that I enjoy hanging out with and I enjoy talking to, right? But I think it also, as a golf coach, at least for me, I think it gives me, if those are the spots I'm looking at, it also gives me a lot of clues on where to look. Okay, the curvature is off. Why is the curvature off? Either there's something wrong with the path, or there's something wrong with the face, or there's whatever there is that was wrong, or there's something wrong with the launch, which means there might be something wrong with the angle of attack, or there might be something wrong with the dynamic loft. But then at least I know where to look. And I think that's basically how I look at it. And that would be like the general idea. A person shows up. I think the worse the player is, or the newer the player is at golf, the easier that part is. Because you can't really do anything else if you don't have strike distance direction. It doesn't really matter how good you are at reading a lie or knowing where to land your golf ball or how far your clubs go, because they don't really go the same distance every time, because you're hitting the ground all over the place, or the face is pointing to the right on one ball and then it's pointing left on the next ball and all these different things. But so I think that part is fairly easy. I would then say, again, it doesn't really matter if it's long game, short game, putting. You look for where the ball ends up. Like, how do I create the smallest dispersion, whether it's off the tee, whether it's approach game, whether it's short game, whether it's putting, how do I create the shortest, the smallest dispersion? And then where do I place that dispersion, right? If you're putting, you want to place that dispersion, at least on short putts, about, I don't know, 1 to 2 feet behind the hole. Of course, you can have like the greatest start line in the world when you're putting, but if you're leaving them all a foot short, well, you're not really going to be a great putter. So I think that's the next part. And then it becomes a pretty big thing, because then it becomes an education thing. It's like, do you even know like where to aim the center of your dispersion? Do you know where you're supposed to hit it? Because you're not necessarily supposed to aim it at the flag every single time. In fact, actually, very rarely are you supposed to aim it at the flag. Then the next thing becomes like, do you understand how to read or gauge wind? And I'll tell you something, like the wind doesn't blow, even if it blows the same miles per hour in Texas and in Denmark, it grabs the ball a lot more in Denmark than it does in Texas. So do you also gauge like air density? Do you know like temperature? That has an effect. Then it becomes about lie recognition. How's the ball sitting? Even in the fairway, is it sitting up, down, or in the middle? What type of grass am I hitting off of? If you have a track man and you hit off of enough, if you hit enough places in the world with good golf balls, you find out the balls go very different distances, not only because of altitude and wind and temperature, but and air density, but also of the grass you're hitting from. So just because I'm hitting my 7-iron 150 meters when I'm standing indoors in a simulator, that doesn't mean it's going 150 meters. It could go anywhere between 138 and 162. Or maybe 170 or whatever, depending on where I'm at in the world, right? So knowing that, you need to know. And I mean, it becomes pretty big, right? Then, and all of that, you can basically throw that out the window if you're thinking about what's for dinner when you're about to hit a golf shot. So you gotta be present.
Yeah.
Right?
So that in essence is what you would term as systematic coaching, a very holistically oriented approach to improving your golfer's game, not just making swing changes, yeah, but applying that swing on the field of play under, yeah, pressure where it matters.
And that's where I think the ball flight really comes into play, because if the player logically, like if they actually know that if I do these things, I hit the ball closer to where I want it to go than when I just hit, why would they not do it? If I don't think about anything, I have a 50% chance of hitting the green. But if I make sure the ball position's right here and the handle location's right here, and I make sure I do this one thing on the backswing or I follow through to here, I hit 80% greens regulation. So why would you not? Like, I don't think I think the problem becomes when the player is practicing something and they're hitting it worse than they already were. Or again, they get scared. Like, or they, like, it's uncomfortable. But if I, as a coach, am good at applying the changes that I want to make or the adjustments or the improvements I want to make to the player, if I'm right, they should be hitting the ball better.
Yeah.
So, and they so should no be able such, to take that fairly easily to the course.
So no such thing as getting worse before you get better. I've never seen anyone doing stack and tilt go through that.
No. And that's what I thought was so impressive.
Yeah. My first experience was with stack and tilt was in 07. I took a 60-year-old student. He didn't have much club head speed. He's like, oh, I can't get my 4-iron up into the air. I said, ball position here, handle location. It started hitting high draw. 4-iron. And it's very counterintuitive because, like, hey, hang on. You're going to put the ball back in your stance, and then you're going to put your weight forward that gets the ball up in the air. It's counterintuitive to a lot of people. But thankfully, with Veda these days, you kind of can see why it works.
I thought it made sense as soon as I learned the actual ball flight laws.
Yeah.
I remember reading that 07 Golf Digest article when I was still a player, going through the backwards ball flight laws, going like, that looks like the biggest push slice in the world. That's what I would like, open the face. All right, so the ball's going to end up over to the right. And then on top of that, then swing more to the right. Like it's going to, that's how I looked at it. Like that's just because that was my system or whatever. That's how I organize stuff, right? So it just became really, really. Hang on 1 second. I'm back.
Carry on. We're talking about swinging to the right.
So, but I mean, if you know that opening the face, well, not only helps the ball start to the right, it also adds loft to the club. And if you can get your path to the right of that face, the ball should be higher than if you're closing the face and putting the ball forward and swinging to the left of that face.
So let's talk. I want to talk a little bit about the order of technical changes. Well, you and I spent a fair amount of time with a guy by the name of Kelvin Meyer-Hira.
Yeah.
How has his system of looking at the golf swing through anatomical terms helped you?
I think that's what it actually helped with, was the anatomy. Was the actual anatomy and helping out with, and I think him and actually Andy Plummer really, really helped me out with knowing what am I looking at when I record a golf swing. If I just look at a video, what am I looking at? I think, and again, right? I think some of the stuff, I think what helped, what Kelvin did was absolutely amazing. But I also felt like it became a lot of this is the right way of doing it and everybody else are wrong, or it's not a superior way of hitting a golf ball.
Yeah.
And I mean, and I think, I don't know, probably 10 years ago, I think I also thought there was a superior way of hitting a golf ball. I don't really think there is anymore, if I'm being honest, like as long as you just kind of conform to these things. Because if you think about what I just said before, like all the things that goes into a guy being a really good approach player, if the only feedback loop the player has is that every time the ball didn't go where I wanted it to go, it's because of my swing, I think they will end up being disappointed in the end. But I do think for sure, like I would read all those articles by Kelvin. I thought they were awesome. I even think, like, if you look really far back, I think I even participated in one of those articles. Yeah. Like I stood out in the snow and like I practiced in some of these things.
I'll tell you exactly what that article was. It was an article for early extension. You had your ass next to a chair trying to keep it behind.
Yes. Yeah.
I thought that was that was amazing.
It showed us,
right? It showed us that the fixes sometimes is illogical, not what we think it should be.
No. Oh, for sure. Right. And again, you're looking at 2D video. I mean, if you don't look at it as a three-dimensional movement, 2D video, it becomes pretty confusing. That's why I also think as a golf instructor, I don't use a lot of 3D, but I really, really like studying 3D. Like I really enjoy looking at graphs, and I used to do that all the time just to basically train my eyes. Like, what am I looking at here? And I think that's really, really good. But again, if that's where you start, then you're probably in trouble, because then you don't know what the point of it was. The point was to get the ball to behave better.
Yeah, it always points down to that. Like Jesse and I always have this saying, right? The golf swing is simply applying the club face to the ball. That's the very essence of the golf swing. And if you can't, your golf swing can't help you apply the sweet spot to the ball consistently, then we've got to see why that is so. And that's where diagnostic tools come in. But I think a lot of, I think there's this bifurcation, there's this divide between instructors. Oh, I'm only going to be high tech. Then there are some guys like we go, I only want to be low tech. So with that in mind, can you talk a little bit about what coaches misunderstand about having a system? Because doctors have a system.
I think, of course they do. Of course they do. Why would you ever go to a doctor who doesn't have a system?
And say, hey, I'm going to diagnose you by feel, Andreas. We would run out of that room.
Let's try this out. See what happens. I don't think that you have to have one system. I think all the best coaches that I've observed and learned from, they all have a system in place. Now, they might call it something else. They might call it a decision tree, or they might not even be aware of it. But I for sure see systems. When I see this, I will try to do this. Oh, why did you decide to do that as your first option? Well, because that works the most often. Okay, what are you going to do if that's not going to work? Well, then I'm going to go to option B and C and D. And like, that's, you've got to have some sort of system in place. Now, I think a lot of people are scared of being pigeonholed. Oh, you're a system coach. Of course I'm who would not be a system coach? You have there's to a lesson, there's basically three phases, right? Like there's what's going on. Now you can, in that area, you can do, I mean, I guess you can diagnose for days and put people through 3D labs, and you can put them in, you could do blood work, and you could do all kinds of stuff if you wanted to. Or you can, at the very least, you can probably record the swing and look through it, but like, what's going on? If you're fortunate, you have a launch monitor, so you can actually also see what's going on with the golf ball and what's going on at impact with the club to the golf ball. But that's the what, right? Then there's the why. Like, I wonder why he's doing that. Is it just because he thinks that's the right way to do it? Or is it because is he really like, maybe he might be trying to do what he's actually doing? Or it's because there's something, you know, you have like injury, or there's injury prevention, or you have like a bad knee or a bad hip or whatever. And then the last part's the how. All right, how are we going to fix this? I think a lot of people end up like, I think you got to be good in those three areas. And I think a lot of people, if they don't know the what, so if their like initial analysis of what's going on isn't spot on, or they're not confident that it's spot on, then if the why and the how doesn't work the very first time, then they all of a sudden they start changing the what. They go like, oh, then it must be something different. Or it might just be that your very first advice or your very first way to improve this problem just wasn't right for that player. All right, we're going to go with option number two or three or four. Just like if you go to the doctor, right? I have a cold. All right, here's, I don't know, like some nose spray and some pills. All right, I did it for 5 days. It didn't really go away. All right, might be like a little worse than I thought. Let's do this instead. But it's not going to be like, all right, let's check how your something else is doing. So I think that's the important part. I think what I've experienced now, we've done these things called systematic coaching for 2 years now, myself. And so far, at least what I've learned and what I've experienced is that a lot of coaches have a wealth of knowledge. They've attended a lot of seminars and they have accumulated a lot of knowledge, and they just don't, they have a hard time organizing it. So they don't know when to use what. So they get thrown around and like they attend, I don't know, something. Now that's what I coach. And then they attend something different. And now that's what I coach. And then they attend something different. And now that's what I coach. Instead of looking at it as like they're adding knowledge and they're adding tools to their toolbox. So now they can help even more people. Or they have a couple of blind spots where there's some, when this happens in a golf swing, I'm not sure what to do. Oh, I learned that at this seminar. So now I'm going to add that to my toolbox. Instead of going, now I'm going to wipe the slate clean. I'm going to start over. Now this is what I'm teaching. Does that make sense?
It sounds like those guys have plenty of tools from all these seminars, but the toolbox is not organized in a coherent way.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay,
there's not a system in place.
Yeah, I got a drill from Andreas. Let's go drill some holes. And then next week, I go see Hugh. Hugh gives me a hammer. Let's go look for some nails to hammer. And I think what you say resonates with what I see. It's like, oh, what's Golf Digest talking about? What's Twitter saying? And then you just go try it. It works. Like, hey, you know, you keep doing it until the next best thing. And there's this journey where you just keep circling the desert without actually reaching the top of the mountain. And the funny thing is, you mentioned, they've got all the information, they've got all the tools. All they need is a system.
I think
system
so. Of organization. I think most do. Yeah, I think so. At least, and I guess there could be other people who feel differently. I have no clue, but I wouldn't know what to do. I wouldn't know what to decide if I didn't have a system in place. Like, just as an example, I got this from Andy, but I think it's a great example. Like, player shows up, they're push slicing the golf ball. Why is the player push slicing the golf ball? Well, the face to path is open. Fair enough. But why is the face to path open? Is it because they are swinging too far to the right? Is it because they might be swinging too far to the left? Is it because their chest is too closed? It might be because their chest is too open. Is it because their lead wrist is too extended? Or hell, it might be because their lead wrist is too flexed. Those could all be reasons for push slicing a ball. How do I know which one it is? That's the next part. Is that's why I think people also need some sort of model.
Yep.
So I know when is something too much or when is something not enough.
So actually, let's talk a little bit about your method, quote unquote, stack and tilt, and what people misunderstand about it. You know, you mentioned a model. So the funny thing is this, right? You really understand stack and tilt, you realize it's a system of spectrums. There's a range for every position.
Yes. I think that was the most important thing. Sorry, you go ahead.
No, I said it's easier to just see it and attack it without trying to understand, going under the hood and understanding what's this system.
Yeah, I think that's the very first, I recall this as the very first thing I learned from Andy was looking at, who was it? It was Troy Madison and JJ Henry on a spectrum up against each other, where one guy can't get the driver in the air because he doesn't spin the ball enough, and the other guy can't hold the green with a sand wedge because he's spinning them off every green. And of course, the two of them move differently, completely differently. And of course, the way they need to improve is completely different. One of them needs to add spin. He needs to open the face to the path. He needs to create more angle of attack. And the other guy, or I guess now the really big word is spin loft, right? One of the guy needs to add spin loft, and the other guy needs to take some spin loft off of it. Yeah. So of course, what they are practicing and the way they practice is completely different. And I think that's your spectrum, right? And I think that's basically how all of it works. It always works on spectrum.
So let's talk a little bit about Andy's impact on you. You used to say that you could finish Andy's sentences. Talk a little bit about your so-called apprenticeship and his mentorship to you and the time that you guys have spent together.
Oh, it's been like, so we haven't, I actually haven't seen him since COVID, just because I ended up getting busy. It became a little bit more difficult to get to the States. But before that, I think for those 8 years, I think I at least saw him once a year, but likely 2 to 3 times a year. I would attend pretty much whatever network training was around. If he was in Denmark, I would offer to drive him to wherever he needed to go. I think I've spent, I don't know, 20 to 25 days watching him coach. What I really think the magic is actually watching him coach and teach, because I think that's the really brilliant part of him, is that he's a teacher and a coach. And I think he's really, really good at knowing when to teach and knowing when to coach. I think I spent those 8 years in the beginning, I spent a lot of time just trying to copy pretty much everything he did, because I just thought that those were the best golf lessons I'd ever seen. So I was like, all right, if I just think about it, like, what would Andy do in this situation? I'm just going to do that. Worked out pretty well. I watched, hell, I don't know how many, like hundreds of hours of recordings of seminars that friends of mine had recorded also, that I would just listen to in my car, or if I was picking balls on the range or something. I think on top of that, after a while, I don't know, it just got me thinking, like, okay, I felt like keep listening, keep listening, keep listening. And the way I actually usually learn most stuff is to try and poke holes in it. So I'd start poking holes. And every time I'd meet Andy, I would have a list of new questions, just because it helps my understanding. It's not about right and wrong. I'm just way better if I poke holes and stuff, or learn way better instead of just sitting there nodding. I did that for a long time. He's been really, really hard to poke holes in. And when I had no more holes to poke, really, I was like, all right, I think I get it now. And I won't say that, like, I was like, okay, now I'm done, now I'm going to move on, because I'm not. But I was like, you know what? I'm pretty good now. I don't need to like go further down this rabbit hole. Now I think it's time for me to see if I can improve upon what Andy taught me, and not necessarily in the geometry. I'm not trying to produce a new ball flight law or produce like something, but see if I can find, can I find better ways, drills to accomplish the things that Andy would use, or the ways Andy would do it. That's basically been basically been the goal ever since. It's like, can I polish this up? Like, how come I end up down? Like, how come all my players end up with this problem, or some of them end up with this problem, or what am I missing, and all these different things. And I think that I have, over the years now, the way my coaching deal is set up, I see my players a lot, very, very often. So I don't really give a lot of like lessons. I just see them all the time. And then we work when they need work. And a lot of the time I just observe, or I challenge, or I do something else. But I think through that, Andy was really good at getting somebody like to completely change in 20 minutes. And I think with the way my program works, which is very long-term, I think I'd rather like it to just kind of slowly, gradually improve over time, instead of like completely changing something from one day to the next. But my situation is different also.
Yeah. I mean, I'm amazed at the number of successful professional golfers that Scandinavia has turned out. Sweden's a good example. We had Gabriel Jettstedt on last week. And in Denmark,
yeah, they're almost as good as Denmark.
What's the reason for that? I mean, you guys have the harshest weather around. I've been to Norway. It's no joke at minus 10 degrees Celsius.
Yeah.
But I think it's probably to do with the number of golf courses per capita and the ease of access.
Yeah, I would say that's likely the number one thing is actually the ease of access. Like how affordable golf is will make a huge difference. It is one of the cheaper sports you can play in Denmark.
Not in Singapore, man.
No, it's. I mean, a junior membership at a club in Denmark where you can play as much as you want. You can hit as many balls as you want. And you get 1 hour of like weekly group training is, what is that in dollars? $120 a year?
A year?
Yeah. Wow,
that's really cheap, man.
It's, so membership-wise, golf is, it's a huge advantage. Like we're basically all our youth has at least the opportunity to play golf versus places where it's like the top percentile who has the opportunity to play golf. Who do you think is hungrier? Who do you think it's just like if you're a runner in Jamaica, at least like you've at least tried running on a track, right?
Yeah.
So I think that's probably, I think that's number one. And I think it's the same in Sweden. Now, of course, can golf be expensive in Denmark? Of course it can be. You can make it as expensive as you want, but it doesn't have to be. The clubs pay, a lot of the places, the clubs pay for the players' tournament fees. So if you're a junior golfer, all you need is a golf set. And it doesn't have to be the newest, nicest, whatever. You can like get a, you know, an older set or something like that, at least over time. There's a lot of the equipment manufacturers are good. If you're decent at golf, they're good at giving you some pretty good discounts on equipment. The clubs pay for your tournament entries. So it doesn't have to be all that expensive. That gives us a huge leg up compared to everybody else. It's also an interesting thing to see if we go to, if the Danish third level pros go to a place like Germany to play like a co-sanctioned event between the Pro Golf Tour and the Nordic League, like you can certainly see in the car park who are the Nordic League players and who are the players from Germany and Holland and these places. You've got like BMW M5s and like Mercedes and all these things on one side. And then you got like these little bitty Volkswagen ups and like all these little crap cars on the other side. And it's usually the guys with the crap cars who end up winning. So I think that's number one. I don't know how it works in Sweden, but I do know that in Denmark, we have a very, very good dialogue. Let's just say we're five or six coaches outside of the Danish Golf Union or the national coaches who coach a lot of the really good players. There's six national team coaches. The six of them and the six of us have a very, very good dialogue. So it doesn't become about like coaches taking over or being pissed. I feel like we're all helping the player out as much as we can, where at least my impression is that at least in the rest of Europe, it's pretty much every single coach who brought up a player who gets into the national team, they hate the national team coaches because then they take over from there and then they teach them something differently. And a lot of players stagnate when they then get into that program because now they have to adjust to a whole new coach language, methodology, et cetera, right?
A lot to learn from the Danish system.
Or socialists.
Google it. That helps.
Yeah.
How do you get hooked up with Humar?
Funny story. So he came and presented at the Danish PGA Summit a couple of years ago. That year, Marcus, who I coach, had just won the Challenge Tour but hadn't made his debut on the DP World Tour yet. I don't mind making mistakes, but I really enjoy learning from other people's mistakes, or I prefer to do that. So when he was done presenting, I asked like if I could get his phone number because I actually had some questions for him because he'd been out on the DP World Tour for 20 years. And I basically wanted to just learn do's and don'ts. Not long afterwards, during that day, I actually, like I sat in my hotel room and I wrote him a text like, dude, can I buy you a beer or something? I just want to talk. And we sat down and we talked. And I think we started talking at like 5 o'clock. And before you know it, it's like 3:30 in the morning. We're pretty drunk. But we had a really, really, like we had some really good conversations. Like the do's and don'ts ended up taking 20 minutes and the rest was about all kinds of stuff. And what we really found out was that we were extremely different in a lot of the ways we do things and very, very different in what we believe in and what we think is more important than other things and how the player moves. think some of it comes from our background. He's been out on tour trying to get players to make money every week for 20 years. Whereas most of my players, I meet them when they're like 11, 12, 13 years old. So I have a little bit longer of a leash, at least. Like, I need to educate players. He needs to just make sure that they function every week. But what we did agree on was that systems were important and you start at the golf ball, which was basically what we agreed upon. Like, I think our analysis are different. I think our whys are different. And I think for sure our hows are different. But the thing was that at least our resumes say that most of the players that come to us get better. And we agreed that, you know what, I think this is, yeah, but we also agreed that we think this would be a better seminar, that we both did it together because we don't agree on a whole lot and we don't have to agree on a whole lot. There's a couple of key things we have to agree on is that it starts at the golf ball and you have to have a system. But what's in it doesn't have to be the same. Where usually a lot of seminars that I've gone to is like, this is how you should do it. And I think that sometimes also gets confusing instead of people actually seeing that there's a lot of different ways of being fairly successful. So we agreed on that and we decided, you know what, I think it was you who said it, you know, like he's looking at me going like, dude, people would like learn from this if we had just recorded these 7 hours that we've just sat around. That wasn't even seven. It was like 10 hours we've been sitting around talking. If we've recorded these 10 hours, coaches would have improved. So he goes, let's try and make a seminar out of it. So we've done it and we have done it. Where have we been? We've been to Austria, done a couple in different places in England. We're going to Barcelona in March, going to San Francisco in June. Can't wait to do that. So we've done that. Feels good. I feel like we're helping people out. I feel like we're helping coaches improve, which means that we are helping golfers getting better.
Yeah, and all these seminars can be found on Hugh's website under Systematic Coaching 1.0 yes. and 2.0.
Yeah, we've had some of them recorded, and we thought just because there's some people, we screw up the dates and stuff, and it's in season. It's hard to figure out when it's actually good for people to attend these things. So we decided to record them. So some people were actually just sitting there online, on Zoom, watching these seminars as we were doing it, asking questions to make it interactive. And then we've got the other ones coming up, right? So we've got the Barcelona one and the San Francisco one at Olympic Club. I can't wait to see that place.
That's nice.
I'm actually really looking forward to getting one of those hot dogs with the beef in it.
They're called burger dogs.
Burger dogs, exactly. That's the one I'm looking forward to.
They're really good.
And any words of advice for coaches aspiring to be like you?
I think the cool thing is that actually, if you dig deep enough, a lot of what you need to learn is actually online. Like, there's a lot, and there's even more. Now there's even back tapes on YouTube and stuff, right? There wasn't back then. I think if I was going to say something, I would say get really, really good at the basics of the game. And I don't mean necessarily grip, setup, posture. I would say become an absolute expert on ball flight. So that means do the TrackMan University. I think that's free of charge, actually. Do like all of it you can. Afterwards, go on YouTube, find John Graham's old deep playing video, is really dry, but it's also very, very educational.
Even James Light's, right? For that matter.
Yeah, even the James Light ones, do those. Even watch Brian Mansell's 30-minute deep plane video on that little plane thing he's got. But I really like become an absolute black belt in ball flight. You don't need to have it's great to have a launch monitor, but you don't need to have it to educate yourself in this. Yep. I didn't have it for the first four years I coached golf, but just because I knew ball flight laws helped me improve. I could look at a golf ball and go like, you know what? I wasn't getting the path right, but I knew it was like somewhat to the right and the face was close to the path. I could see that because the ball was darting right and drawn back, right? I at least get that right. Even purchase Theodore Jorgensen's, is it The Physics of Golf? Read it, study it. Because I think that if you don't have that right, you just like if you were coding, get the first part right.
Yeah.
And then you can start moving out from there.
Print, I would also, world. Yeah. I mean, get that correct first.
Yeah. Yes. I would attend Stack and Still training. Like, that doesn't mean that I don't care. Like, if people use the brand to like help their business, or they don't want to be like use the brand, whatever's good by me. I don't think anybody has ever gotten worse,
yeah,
by attending Stack and Still training. I think they've only gotten better. I think if you don't, I think you're scared of something, and I think you're scared of being judged and all these different things. And to be honest, like, I don't think there's a name in the book I haven't been called in Denmark, and the amount of players that have been told by other coaches that, it's the Stack and Tilt stuff, right? No, you're doing the, all this stuff, right? In the beginning, I would get angry and I'd call people up and go like, dude, what do you think? Like, why are you doing this? Right. At the end of the day, I can't change all of that. Like, the only thing I need to, like, my entire business is built around helping players improve. So honestly, what do I really care about what people who I don't really know think of me?
Yeah. You can't please everyone. And the really wise coaches.
I'm not trying either.
Yeah. Yeah, wise coaches used to tell me that from the start. You know what? You can't please everyone. And when you finally get the results that they want, they'll come to you. True enough.
Yeah.
That's been
my experience. Well, that was the thing, right? Like, back,
yeah,
we went to, it's, what's that now? 10, 12 years ago, we'd go to the PGA Summit. Like, nobody would hardly, like, a lot, well, some would, but a lot of people wouldn't even talk to me, wouldn't shake my hand, because I was the dude, the junior academy, teaching people all these technical things, making things too complicated, hurting people. I was the Stack and Tilt guy, yada, yada, yada. 10 years later, we've got guys on the European tour who weren't even in national teams back when we started with them. We've got guys on the Challenge Tour. We've got girls playing the LPGA, playing the Olympics, all these different things. And all of a sudden, everybody wants to say hello, right? It was like, dude, I didn't change. Like, I'm still doing what I was doing. Nobody got hurt. People improved. Yeah. And it's, and again, I'm not going to try and change people's mind. I'm going to do my thing and do it as best as I can. Luckily, I don't have all the answers. So I keep like trying to figure them out. Now I'm like going to a deep dive on like breath and how I think breath might like have a really big effect on how present I can be when I actually execute a golf shot.
The sympathetic and the parasympathetic.
I think there's something there that could help my players out. So, you know what? I think it's worth pursuing.
You need to invite Wim Hof to your academy.
Yeah, well, he's a little too crazy for me, I think. But he's for sure there's something down that road where I think there's some really good stuff that happens. I can't help but think of these like world champion like boxers and MMA artists and guys like that who basically, like Floyd Mayweather, looks like he's the most relaxed person in the world until that bell rings, and then he looks like an absolute murderer. Same thing goes for Tyson Fury and these guys that can just kind of like click in and out. And I think that has, I don't know. All right. This is just something I think. I think that might have some really big value in high performance golf, where you basically have to check in and out like quite a bit over a 72-hole tournament.
Yeah.
And I wonder how they do it.
We have a friend by the name of Jane Story, who's been doing Tai Chi and golf for the longest time. She has done a lot of research on breath in golf. Might be worth checking her. I think she's written, what, Jesse, 3 books? Connected Putting, Breath, really? And Connected Golf.
Yeah. And she's got
Jane
a new
Story.
One. Yeah, she's got a new one coming out too here very soon.
Okay.
JaynEstorey. Jane Story.
Very interesting. Down as we speak. Jane Story. Yeah, because currently I'm reading a book called Breath, which I just think is by
is it James Nestor?
James Nestor, exactly. Yeah, and I think
that's
fairly interesting.
Great book.
So now I don't breathe through my nose anymore, at least.
Oh yeah.
Or through my mouth. It's all through my nose.
Yeah, and then he wrote about people having like the, you know, when they're growing up, weird jaw lines and all that, if you're breathing through your mouth. So I tell my two girls, 7 and 5, you breathe through your nose, not your mouth. You want a nice jawline, you do that.
Yep.
So in closing, Andreas, what will you be doing in 10 years' time?
10 years, I will be 51. I will more than likely still be at the same junior academy I'm at. I really enjoy it. it's a fun journey to be on with these players. I think in 10 years, my boys will be 21 and 24 years old. Wow. So they probably won't see me. They won't need me around all that much anymore. I'll probably likely travel a little bit more on the DP World Tour.
I'm going to Singapore, man.
This might sign there. Yeah, you could even go to Singapore, right? I have an expectation that within the next 5 years, that five of our players will have at least full category in DP World Tour or better. Might sound a bit arrogant, but I think that's the direction it's heading. So I'll have to travel a bit more. I have an expectation that I'll still be traveling, doing some seminars if coaches want me to come and help them out. Because I find that I didn't know that that's something I enjoyed, but I really, really enjoy it. And I find it extremely meaningful knowing that, because I mean, that's the problem as a golf coach is that you only have like certain X amount of hours in the day. And if I really want to make a difference and help golfers enjoy the game better, I can't coach anymore than I already do. So I have two options. Either I make like an online video set or something, which I'm not sure how much that's going to do. It could help some people at Slice maybe, but I'm not sure, like it becomes a little too general. So I think if I can help other coaches organize their stuff better, if they can learn from some of my mistakes and maybe even hold on to, like maybe even grab onto a couple of things that I prefer, I think I would really like, I think that's what I want to do. We'll see if that's what ends up happening.
Where can our listeners find you?
Well, on Instagram, probably. I have a website, but to be honest, like it's not even really finished. I wouldn't look at my website. I would go on Instagram, find me on Andreas Cali Golf. They can, if they are golf pros and they want to learn some more, they can either go to Hugh Marr's website. I think it's just, yeah. Is it just Hugh Marr Golf or is it Hugh Marr?
It's actually coacheducation.com/Hugh Marr.com. I'll put all of that in the show notes so that our listeners know where to go.
We have a couple of videos that are available to purchase. I don't know if people are being nice or the reviews are really good, but people have been really, really happy with them. The people that have watched them. Again, we're going to Barcelona in late March. If anybody wants to attend there, they're more than welcome. Again, we're going to San Francisco. I think I have a couple of other things without Hugh coming up, like Austria. I'm going to the PGA Summit in Germany. And then if not, like people can reach out. Like I'm not the greatest at responding fast to things just because I'm fairly busy. But I do have some admin time at times where I sit down and I try to clean out my inbox and respond to everybody who writes me. So if people have questions, they can reach out. And again, I travel a bit. So if people see me, like they should come over and say hello at least. I like meeting other golf coaches.
Fantastic. And there you have it. Andreas Cali, one of the best golf coaches in the world.
Thanks, Andreas.
Thank you, Andreas.
Thanks, guys. I had a blast.